Hello, I'm Nicholas Barrett.
And hello, I'm Guntram Wolf.
And I'm Maria de Mertes.
And you are listening to The Sound of Economics. Today, we think we have a deal. Jean-Claude Juncker, Michel Barnier, Boris Johnson seem to be able to agree on something. Guntram, you have been tweeting that this is good news. Why is it good news?
Well, first of all, it's good news because no deal would be quite disruptive for both the European Union, Ireland in particular, but also, of course, the United Kingdom economy. And so in that sense, it's a good news that there is some sort of a deal. But I think we should look carefully at this deal. And I think the deal has a couple of key elements. It de facto establishes a backstop for Northern Ireland. So what is a backstop? Well, it basically means Northern Ireland stays in the single market and in the customs union of the European Union, which means there will be a customs border in the Irish Sea, which is a major concession from the British Prime Minister. He's always resisted that very, very much. And the concession from the EU side is to say, well, we accept that there is some sort of democratic control on the side of the North Irish Parliament that can every 4 years or so have a look and have a decision on this, subject to a complicated mechanism. And so in the end, this is the concession that the EU wasn't ready to give before. The EU was always insisting, well, this has to be without time limits, because otherwise there's always a danger that the conflict in the Belfast Agreement and the peace process would be jeopardized in a few years down the road. This has now been conceded, and I think it has been conceded because people start to realize also on the EU side that if you don't do this, very quickly, you will have to install a real border on the island of Ireland, which would immediately lead to a disruption.
Maria, was this inevitable?
Well, I mean, I think it's good news in some way, because, as Guntram said, because there is some predictability now. I think we shouldn't jump the gun, because that still needs to go through Parliament, and it's not obvious that it will go through Parliament. And if it doesn't, then we're back to square one. But at least we have that first step, which we haven't had till now. So I think that is progress. And, you know, with any bargaining that is going on, both parties need to find a middle way. Middle way means getting back on red lines, or at least attempted red lines. What I think is different is the fact that, I mean, you know, the issue of the backstop, which had been very, very dear to the EU, it was, of course, of a permanent basis in the arguments that the EU was made, but because it referred to the whole of the UK. This time is a non-permanent backstop, but it doesn't refer to the whole of the UK, it refers to Northern Ireland. Arguably, you could say that Northern Ireland is a big winner out of what happened today, because they remain both in the EU, the customs union, and the UK, and they don't get a border. Now, if of course you're a hard Brexiteer, and as we've heard the Prime Minister saying, you know, that it becomes almost a sort of a semi-colony of the EU. This is how Mr. Boris Johnson had argued it. If you're a hard Brexiteer, you would not find this necessarily good news. But I mean, in terms of continuity of economics, continuity of what we have, I think this is good news for Northern Ireland. I think the big risks, if that deal were to go through, is on the argument that both Mrs. May and others have made, and that is about the continuity and cohesion of the UK Union. What would this mean for, effectively, Great Britain and the United Kingdom is not so clear, and I think we need to be watching Scotland very closely.
It could be quite embarrassing for Westminster if the Northern Irish economy grew faster than other regions in the years ahead.
Well, there would be, whether it's embarrassing or not, if you believe that the UK, the EU, the single market, is a good economic deal, then that is true. But it's people know about this, and the fact that they want to exit is because they don't believe that this is true. We'll see.
But I mean, on this point, I think Northern Ireland, there's a couple of things here, right? I mean, one important point is that Northern Ireland will get some sort of a customs border with the UK, and a lot of the trade of Northern Ireland is with the UK. And so in that sense, they will rather have a disadvantage because of that border. The second point, however, is that Boris Johnson might want to get the votes of the DUP supporting this deal in the end. And to do this, I think there will be basically a monetary side to this, meaning the DUP will negotiate more subsidies and transfers coming from Westminster to Northern Ireland. And in that sense, I think they will receive more transfers, which will be good for their economy, not for their production, but good for their consumption. And they will have some sort of a customs control, which will also hamper their production sites. So in the end, people might still be happy because they can consume, but they might not have a lot of interesting jobs. But who knows what the precise deals are in the domestic British politics will be. But it seems to me, if Boris Johnson doesn't get the DUP votes on this, no single DUP vote on this, his majority is actually, the majority for this deal might be extremely fragile. So he would really take a big gamble. So I would expect that he actually offers some money to Northern Ireland, it seems to me.
I was scrolling through Twitter just before we started recording, and it seems like the DUP will not be voting for the deal, and they're not going to be abstaining either. They're going to be voting against it.
Yeah, so what happens to Labour, I think, will be defining there. If there are dissidents on the Labour deal, because the Labour line is that they're not going to support this, but if there are dissidents...
That's a Corbyn line, yeah.
A Corbyn line,
but there seem to be 30 or 40 people among Labour that prefer to have a deal than no deal Brexit. And so that's the choice effectively.
Indeed, yeah.
But even among the DUP, there might be a few that in the end will defect, depending on... What's on the table?
For listeners who aren't following this as obsessively as we are, the DUP are the Democratic Unionist Party, and they're the kind of conservative right-wing unionist party in Northern Ireland. Just before we were recording over lunch, I was reading The Economist, and I just want to read a sentence from something they published today. Quote, within 10 years, Mr. Johnson's deal would have reduced Britain's total trade by about 13%, making people roughly 6% or £2,000 a year poorer than they would have been otherwise. Does that sound like something people would notice?
Well, I think it sounds strange because, I mean, the question is relative to what, right? I mean, relative to being in the EU, perhaps, but relative to not having a deal, not at all. So I think a lot now, and, you know, a lot of once the deal has passed on Saturday in the House of Commons, and I would assume it will pass also in the European Parliament very soon, I think all the attention of the policymaking system will be on crafting a deal for the future relation. And this is totally unclear now. We don't know what will be the future relation. Will it be an ambitious free trade agreement? Will it be an unambitious one? I mean, all of this depends really on how comfortable the EU will be about where the UK will go in the next years. And I think the big mantra and the big word here is, will there be massive deregulation on the UK side? I mean, if Boris Johnson wants to take the UK in a direction of massive deregulation, lowering of standards, lowering of labor social standards, lowering of environmental standards, and so on, if that's the direction he wants to take the UK to, I think it will be very difficult to agree on a deep free trade agreement. If, on the other hand, the divergence is quite minor, you know, I think the EU side will probably have an interest to actually sign off on a pretty comprehensive and deep free trade agreement. And, you know, then in the end, the damage to the UK economy might be quite limited, and the damage to the EU economy as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. And it's arguably the real deal begins now, actually. Well, provided, of course, things go past the two parliaments. But the interesting discussions only start now, because it is about, can we find a common ground for having a good cooperation? And exactly as Guntram said, it really depends on the direction of antagonism that the UK is going to pursue. If it's very antagonistic, then the EU is not going to be lenient. If it's cooperative, then the EU is going to also cooperate, because it is to the benefit of both. The good news is that incentives are aligned now. I mean, provided we go through this, the incentives are aligned. We both need to want to do better. And I think we will find a common ground. It took us a long time, a lot of bickering, but I hope that we will be able to move forward.
I think it's important to remember and to consider that there probably hasn't been a worse time in living memory to start striking international trade deals. Just yesterday, the Trump administration retaliated for the EU's subsidies for Airbus, and they slapped 7.5 billion worth of tariffs on EU goods. including 25% tariffs on Scottish whiskey, which employs about 11,000 people in Scotland. That's a tariff that Irish whiskey exporters won't have to pay, which puts Scotland at a huge competitive disadvantage. So maybe there are an alignment of interest between British and European trade negotiators, but this is an incredibly difficult time to strike a trade deal with the United States.
Paradoxically, the US behavior when it comes down to sort of the way that they see the role of global trade has united Europeans into speaking with one voice. And when Europe speaks with one voice, it does a lot better. It remains to be seen whether this is going to be also true with the UK when it comes to the bilateral between the UK and the EU. But I wouldn't preempt the fact that actually that concentrates the minds in the UK aiming to strike a good deal.
Well, it seems like American trade negotiators might want to pressure the United Kingdom towards a more kind of free trade, low regulation, low tax status on the edge of Europe. Something Brexiteers used to talk about a lot before the referendum was a kind of Singapore for Europe.
That's right.
Is that plausible?
Well, I mean, let me also react to the point before. I think the UK has chosen the worst moment to leave the European Union, in the sense that this is a moment when the global multilateral trading system is really collapsing. And, you know, if you have a stable WTO, a stable multilateral system, you're fine as a small country because you can basically trade within that framework. But at a moment where there's no stability and no international trade agreements, you know, you're really, your size and your power depends on your size. And the UK is a small economy, I'm sorry to say. It's a small economy on a global scale, and so has very little assets to leverage really its size and really get a good deal. So they chose the worst moment to really leave the EU.
How long do modern trade deals take?
Well, I think with the EU it could go very quickly because there's full regulatory alignment. It's not like striking a deal between the EU and Mercosur, the Latin American countries, where there's a lot of divergence. So there, everything depends on political will and the extent to which the UK will diverge.
And how about the rest of the world? If the United Kingdom wanted to strike its own trade deal with Canada or India or Japan, how long do you think that would take?
Long time.
Well, it takes a minimum of 2 years. It could go up to 7 years per country. And once the UK leaves the EU, it's going to have to sort of negotiate all the trade deals that the EU has with the countries around the world. So administratively speaking, it is a big burden for the UK.
And Singapore on the Thames, just to react on this point that you made, I mean, Singapore on the Thames, I think, is a nice slogan. It doesn't sound very plausible to me. I mean, it sounds plausible for London, but the UK is not only London. There's a lot of hinterland, if I may use this German word. There's a lot of hinterland which really wants high regulation, good standards, good labor standards, good production standards, and so on and so forth. This is not just a financial center. The UK economy is not just a financial economy like Singapore, Hong Kong. So in that sense, I never really believed that there's, in the end, a political majority for going down the road in the UK to deregulate and become only a center for low taxes, for corporations and big banks.
Now, am I right in thinking that in the meantime, while we're negotiating these big new trade agreements, simultaneously, I might add, with all these other big countries, am I right in thinking that Britain would fall into a kind of WTO default status? What would that be like?
Well, WTO default status means that the UK, as you know, is currently already a member of the WTO, and it is following the schedule of concessions of the European Union, which means the tariffs that the EU applies would be the tariffs that the United Kingdom applies. So this is basically what the UK would like to see. And the EU, both the EU and the UK, have notified WTO partners that this is how it should look like post-Brexit. Now, there's some debate on technical debates on tariff quotas, so the extent how to distribute and split up the meat quotas and so on and so forth. But at the end of the day, I think the default is that the UK will become a WTO member under the same conditions, the same tariffs as the European Union. The problem, however, is, and that's what I tried to point out, the problem is that the WTO might stop being a functioning organization by the end of this month. because the appellate body, so the court that takes decisions in case of disagreements between WTO countries, will not have a sufficient number of judges as of basically November or December, because the United States is blocking the appointment of a new judge. And so in that sense, I think the real danger here is that the UK ends up being like an EU country in terms of the tariffs under the WTO, but cannot enforce anything because basically the legal avenues for enforcing that are gone.
And can I ask, is WTO membership automatic once there's Brexit? Let's suppose there's...
No, but they are already. So the all the EU countries are members of the WTO as individual countries, and then the EU as a whole is a member.
Maria, how do you think ordinary British people would experience life outside of the single market and customs union? How might they notice?
Well, I think there will be price effects, but these are, of course, difficult to disentangle. I think the biggest thing for the UK citizens is going to be the travel. But something that they're going to witness is how easy it would be for them to settle in another country by comparison to what it was up to what it is right now. I think that's going to be, if any, the eyes of the ordinary citizen. This would be the immediate effect, given that there is flows of people that are coming across the channel every day. That would be the biggest difference, I think. Beyond that, the economics will materialize. I'm sure of that. But whether it is visible on a daily frequency, that of course is a little more difficult to.
So no more British pensioners living and settling in Spain.
Or indeed, UK students traveling on Erasmus across European universities. Mm.
I should say that there's a very good chance that this deal will not get through the House of Commons on Saturday, in which case I don't know what happens. Is there going to be an extension? Are we going to be here again in a few months? The EU already said they wouldn't renegotiate this deal, and then they did. Okay. Does that mean the British can just carry on asking again and again for renegotiation?
That's right. I mean,
all of this is, of course, in the end, it's political. And politicians always say, I will never do this. And then in the end, they have to cross a red line just to get something done, right? And so I think here, perhaps one deadline is the new commission. So the current commission will not end its term end of October. It will be extended by a month. So this commission gets extended by a month, end of November. Because of the hearings and so on that some commissioners didn't pass, and so they have to reconfigure. So one possible new deadline could be in a month's time, so end of November, a real final deadline. But then again, I mean, how credible is it, and how much would the EU really say? I mean, now it's enough, and we just accept a no-deal Brexit. I mean, who knows? I think in the end, the EU doesn't want to be seen as the one that pushes out the UK. So in the end, I think a lot will be driven really by the UK domestic politics.
If the deal doesn't pass now, there is, of course, the law that has passed in the House of Commons, which prohibits the nation from exiting with a hard Brexit. So that will kick in, I think. And then the question is there an extension? And for an extension to be given, it has to be asked. And I agree with Guntram that I don't think the EU will pull the plug itself. I just cannot see the EU saying no more extensions. However, it will ask for if there is a demand for yet another extension, they will ask for what cause, what will happen in the extension if granted. And then, of course, a number of different things can happen. It will be renegotiations, or it will be some sort of a proof that there will be a new referendum, or there will be elections. These are the sort of the possibilities of what could happen. But the time frame for any of this is different. So I think that if there were to be a demand for a new extension, then there will have to be a good illustration of what will happen and at what term. And then, of course, again, is this ad infinitum? It could very well be. I don't think it's good to be ad infinitum, but I mean, it would be very, very difficult for the EU to pull the plug first.
So this negotiation, it was very last minute. It was very frantic. It seems to me that the British government needed it more than the Europeans did, and it also seems like it's more favourable to the Europeans than the British. And I think that's probably not a coincidence. As time goes by, if we do find ourselves here again, the longer this goes on, does the British position just come weaker the longer this goes on?
Who knows? I mean, And there's many people who think Brexit in the end might never happen because it's actually impossible for the UK economy in particular. So clearly, I think what we've been seeing since the referendum is not only a dramatic decline of British influence on the continent. I mean, this is really one of the most striking effects of the Brexit referendum. The UK has lost massively as a political power in Europe. But I think what we've also seen that the UK economy, and people have realized this, that the economy, UK economy will be much more affected by a no-deal Brexit than the EU economy. The EU economy will be affected, the German economy will be affected, the German car industry will be affected, many will be affected, but not to the same extent as the UK economy. And so indeed, the UK is in a weaker negotiating position as long as the EU27 remains united. And the EU, thanks also to Michel Barnier, has understood that very early on and has really being united in this negotiation. One can say perhaps the EU has also been somewhat rigid, and I think that's why today's deal is sort of interesting, because the EU conceded also something. And I think that's, in a sense, it's a good sign, and I think a sign that in the end we might find a deal.
Well, I think what the EU did today is it went back to the original suggestion that it had made. So I don't know whether it was really a concession. It was kind of alternative.
Well, the time limit. I mean, the political control on the backstop. Because that's a concession.
Yeah, but that's for Northern Ireland only, right? It's not a permanent one. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I think what really weakens, I mean, as time goes on, is the case for Brexit. I mean, if there ever was one, but I'm sure there isn't many people in the UK who believe that there is a good case for Brexit. But I think in the eyes of those people, you know, the longer it takes for this to be negotiated, the less kind of relevant it becomes. Because if you can't do it in 2 years, if you can't do it in three, if you can't do it in five, well, can you do it at all? At some point, you know, these questions will be asked. And that's not good for the UK, because some certainty is important. Even if you decide to do something that a priori looks bad for the economy, at least you have a certainty you can reorganize, as it were, and sort of bite the bullet and do it. So I think the case for Brexit will weaken itself, irrespective of whether the negotiating position of the UK weakens or not.
Well, I fear that belief in Brexit has become rather religious and tribal now. I think it was Ian McEwan who said, "We believe it because we believe it." And it's kind of, it exists.
Yeah, ideology is important here, indeed.
And one final question. If this really is the end, and this is really the light at the end of the tunnel and not just the light of an oncoming train, this is surely a sad day for the European Union. Is this the end of the European Union at its peak, or is it the beginning of a more cohesive, more effective European Union? What do we think?
I certainly think it's a sad day. I have never been a proponent of Brexit, and I think losing the UK out, losing for the EU to lose the UK is a bad thing. It's a bad thing for the UK. It's a bad thing for the EU. However, you know, we can have another relationship. Maybe it's not a brotherly relationship, but it's still a cousin's relationship. I think we can do that.
Any thoughts, Guntram?
No, I mean, I entirely agree with what Maria is saying on this point. I mean, it's a sad day, but it's not the end of the relation. Britain remains an integral part of Europe. I mean, that's for sure.
Well, thank you. Go on.
Geography is what it is.
Geography is what it is. Well, thank you, Guntram Moore. Thank you, Maria de Mertzis. And thank you very much for listening.